Does trade cause growth? Yes, the authors answer. All else equal, countries that trade more have higher per capita incomes. Jeffrey Frankel and David Romer, economists at Harvard and UC Berkeley, respectively, conclude, "Our results bolster the case for the importance of trade and trade-promoting policies." Researchers have plenty left to quibble about. That's what researchers do. In the meantime, we have strong theoretical reasons to believe that trade makes countries better off, and solid empirical evidence that trade is one thing that has separated winners from losers in recent decades. The rich countries must do their part by keeping their economies open to exports from poor countries. Mr. Sachs has called for a new compact for Africa. He writes, "The current pattern of rich countries to provide financial aid to tropical Africa while blocking Africa's chances to export textiles, footwear, leather goods, and other labor-intensive products may be worse than cynical. It may, in fact, fundamentally undermine Africa's chances for economic development." Responsible fiscal and monetary policy. Governments, like individuals, will get themselves in serious trouble if they consistently overspend on things that do not raise future productivity. At a minimum, large budget deficits require the government to borrow heavily, which takes capital out of the hands of private borrowers who are likely to use it more efficiently. Chronic deficit spending can also signal other future problems: higher taxes to pay back the debt, inflation to erode the value of the debt, or even default, just giving up on the debt. All of these problems are compounded if the government has borrowed heavily from abroad to finance its profligate spending. If foreign investors lose confidence and decide to take their money and go home, as skittish global investors are wont to do, then the capital that was financing the deficit dries up or becomes prohibitively expensive. In short, the music stops. The government is left on the brink of default, which we've seen in countries ranging from Mexico to Turkey. There is, by the way, some modest concern that this could happen to the United States. On the monetary side, Chapter 10 made clear the dangers of letting the money party get out of control. It happens often anyway. Argentina is the poster child for irresponsible monetary policy. From 1960 to 1994, the average Argentine inflation rate was 127% per year. To put that in perspective, an Argentine investor who had the equivalent of $1 billion in savings in 1960 and kept all of it in Argentine pesos until 1994 would have been left with the equivalent spending power of 1/13th of a penny. Economist William Easterly has noted, "Trying to have normal growth during high inflation is like trying to win an Olympic sprint hopping on one leg." Natural resources matter less than you would think. Israel, which has no oil to speak of, is a far richer country than nearly all of its Middle Eastern neighbors that have large petroleum reserves. Israeli GDP per capita is $28,300, compared to $20,500 for Saudi Arabia and $12,800 for Iran. Meanwhile, resource-poor countries like Japan and Switzerland have fared much better than resource-rich Russia, or consider oil-rich Angola. The country takes in some $3.5 billion a year from its oil industry. What's happened to the people who might benefit from this treasure in the ground? Much of the oil money goes to fund a never-ending civil war that has ravaged the country. Angola has the world's highest rate of citizens maimed by landmines, 1 out of 133. 1/3 of Angola's children die before age 5. Life expectancy is 42. Large swaths of the capital have no electricity, no running water, no sewers, and no garbage pickup. These are not anecdotal examples carefully picked to make a point. Economists believe that a rich endowment of natural resources may actually be a detriment to development. All else equal, it's great to discover the world's largest zinc deposit, but all else is not equal. Commodity-rich countries are changed by the experience in ways that can do more harm than good. One study of economic performance in 97 countries over 2 decades found that growth was higher in countries that were less endowed with natural resources. Of the top 18 fastest-growing nations, only 2 were rich in things that can be taken out of the ground. Why? Mineral riches change an economy. First, they divert resources away from other industries, such as manufacturing and trade, that can be more beneficial to long-term growth. For example, the Asian tigers were resource poor. Their path to prosperity began with labor-intensive exports and progressed into more technology-intensive exports. The countries grew steadily richer in the process. Second, resource-rich economies become far more vulnerable to wild swings in the price of commodities. A country built on oil will have a rough stretch when the barrel price drops from $90 to $15. Meanwhile, demand for a nation's currency rises as the rest of the world begins to buy its diamonds or bauxite or oil or natural gas. That'll cause the currency to appreciate, which, we now know, makes the country's other exports, such as manufactured goods, more expensive. Economists started referring to the perverse effects of abundant natural resources as Dutch disease, after observing the economic effects of an enormous North Sea natural gas discovery by the Netherlands in the 1950s. The spike in natural gas exports drove up the value of the Dutch guilder, as the rest of the world demanded more guilders in order to buy Dutch natural gas, making life more difficult for other exporters. The government also used the gas revenues to expand social spending, which raised employers' social security contributions and therefore their production costs. The Dutch had long been a nation of traders, with exports making up more than 50% of GDP. By the 1970s, other export industries, the traditional lifeblood of the economy, had grown far less competitive. One business publication noted, "Gas so distended and distorted the workings of the economy that it became a mixed blessing for a trading nation." Last, and perhaps most important, countries could use the revenues from natural resources to make themselves better off, but they don't. Money that might be spent on public investments with huge returns, education, public health, sanitation, immunizations, infrastructure, is more often squandered. After the World Bank helped to build an oil pipeline that originates in Chad and runs through Cameroon to the ocean, Chad's president, Idriss Déby, used the first $4.5 million installment of oil money to buy weapons for fighting rebels. Democracy. Does making the trains run on time matter more to the economic growth of poor countries than niceties like freedom of expression and political representation? No, the opposite is true. Democracy is a check against the most egregious economic policies, such as outright expropriation of wealth and property. Amartya Sen, a professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998 for several strands of work related to poverty and welfare, one of which is his study of famines. Mr. Sen's major finding is striking. The world's worst famines are not caused by crop failure. They're caused by faulty political systems that prevent the market from correcting itself. Relatively minor agricultural disturbances become catastrophes because imports are not allowed, or prices are not allowed to rise, or farmers are not allowed to grow alternative crops, or politics in some other way interferes with the market's normal ability to correct itself. He writes, "Famines have never materialized in any country that's independent, that goes to elections regularly, that has opposition parties to voice criticisms, and that permits newspapers to report freely and question the wisdom of government policies without extensive censorship." China had the largest recorded famine in history. 30 million people died as the result of the Great Leap Forward in 1958 to 1961. India has not had a famine since independence in 1947. Economist Robert Barrow's seminal study of economic growth in some 100 countries over many decades found that basic democracy is associated with higher economic growth. More advanced democracies, however, suffer slightly lower rates of growth. Such a finding is consistent with our understanding of how interest groups can promote policies that are not always good for the economy as a whole. War is bad. Now there's a real shocker. Still, the data on the proportion of extremely poor countries involved in armed conflict are strikingly high. Paul Collier, head of the Oxford Center for the Study of African Economies and author of the book The Bottom Billion, points out that nearly three-quarters of the world's billion poorest people are caught in a civil war or have recently been through one. It's hard to run a business or get an education in the midst of a war. Obviously, the causality runs in both directions. War devastates countries. Nations in a shambles are more likely to collapse into civil war. Once again, natural resources can make things worse by financing weapons and giving the factions something to fight over. Collier coined the sadly clever phrase, "Diamonds are a guerrilla's best friend." The important point is that security is a prerequisite for most of the other things that have to happen for an economy to flourish. In 2004, The Economist published a story about the challenges of doing business in Somalia, a country that had been in the throes of civil war for 13 years. The story noted, "There are two ways to run a business in Somalia. You can pay off the local warlord, not always the most trustworthy of chaps, and hope he will stop his militiamen from murdering your staff. Or you can tell him to get stuffed and hire your own militia." Woman power. Imagine two farmers, each with 1,000 acres. One of them cultivates all of his land every year. The other leaves half of his land fallow year after year. Who will grow more? It's not a trick question. The guy who uses all of his land can grow more. What does this have to do with women? Bill Gates made the connection when speaking about technological progress to an audience segregated by sex in Saudi Arabia. A New York Times Magazine article on the role of women in economic development recounts the incident. 4/5 of the listeners were men on the left. The remaining 1/5 were women, all covered in black cloaks and veils on the right. A partition separated the two groups. Toward the end, in the question-and-answer session, a member of the audience noted that Saudi Arabia aimed to be one of the top 10 countries in the world in technology by 2010, and asked if that was realistic. "Well, if you're not fully utilizing half the talent in the country," Gates said, "you're not going to get close to the top 10." The Saudis shouldn't have been surprised. The Arab Human Development Report came to the same basic conclusion in a lot more pages several years earlier. In the 2002 report, several prominent Arab scholars sought to explain the paltry rate of growth in the 22 countries that make up the Arab League. Over the previous two decades, real per capita income growth had been a paltry 0.5% a year, lower than any place in the world except sub-Saharan Africa. One of the three key problems identified by the authors was women status. The other two were a lack of political freedoms and a dearth of human capital. The Economist reported on the findings. 1 in every 2 Arab women still can neither read nor write. Their participation in their country's political and economic life is the lowest in the world. Investing in girls and women can be like planting the other half of that 1,000-acre field. There's another subtle and mildly amusing part of women power. Women in the developing world, and maybe elsewhere, do smarter things with their money. As women get wealthier, they spend more money on the family's nutrition, medicine, and housing. When men get wealthier, they spend more money on alcohol and tobacco. Really. There was an elegant little experiment on this point in the Ivory Coast, where men and women traditionally grow different crops. In some years, the men's cash crops are bountiful. In other years, the women's cash crops do particularly well. MIT economist Esther Duflo found that when the men have a banner year, the household spends more on drinking and smoking. When the women rake in the cash, the household spends more on food. Development officials have learned that if they give cash to the female head of the household, it will do more good. Experts could tick off many other things that matter in the development process. Savings and investment rates, fertility rates, ethnic strife, colonial history, cultural factors, etc. All of which raises a question. If we have a decent idea of what constitutes good policy, why is the path out of poverty so steep and treacherous? The answer lies in the difference between describing why Tiger Woods is a great golfer and actually playing like him. It's one thing to explain what makes rich countries work. It's quite another to develop a strategy for transforming the developing world. Consider some simple examples. Building effective government institutions is easier when the population is literate and educated. Yet decent public education requires effective government institutions. Public health is crucial. But it's hard to build health clinics when huge amounts of money are lost to corrupt officials, and so on. There's a broad continuum of expert opinion on what, if anything, rich countries can do to improve life elsewhere in the world. Jeffrey Sachs anchors one end of that continuum. As you may have inferred from some of the research in this chapter, Sachs believes that impoverished nations are caught in poverty traps, and only capital from the developed world will rescue them. If we were to care and spend more in the developed world, we could jump-start the development process in poor countries, like getting a big boulder moving at the top of a hill. For example, Sachs argues that the world's rich countries should undertake a comprehensive program to fight AIDS in Africa. He reckons that America's share of such a program would cost about $10 a person, the price of a movie and popcorn. So far, U.S. contributions to such efforts have been far smaller. Indeed, America's total foreign aid budget comes to 0.1% of GDP, a fraction of what we're capable of and a third of what the Europeans give. Mr. Sachs warned long before September 11th that we ought to invest in the developing world, not only for humanitarian reasons, but also because even remote countries in turmoil become outposts of disorder for the rest of the world. William Easterly, whose work has also been cited extensively here, anchors the other end of that continuum. He believes that the whole development aid process is broken. His views are best encapsulated by an old joke about the failed development strategies that have gone in and out of favor over the past half century. A peasant discovers that many of his chickens are dying, so he seeks advice from a priest. The priest recommends that the peasant say prayers for his chickens, but the chickens continue to die. The priest then recommends music for the chicken coop, but the deaths continue unabated. Pondering again, the priest recommends repainting the chicken coop in bright colors. Finally, all the chickens die. "What a shame," the priest tells the peasant. "I had so many more good ideas." Easterly should know. He spent decades working at the World Bank, where he was the guy trying to save the dying chickens. He argues in The White Man's Burden and other works that traditional aid projects are inflexible and ineffective. The results are miserable, both at the micro level — aid agencies hand out mosquito nets that end up getting used as fishing nets or wedding veils — and at the macro level. We can't show that what we're doing is making countries better off. Instead, we focus on inputs. How generous are we? Which he compares to evaluating a Hollywood movie by the size of its budget. Easterly says that traditional development aid has been a mistake, because we still haven't figured out how to do it. He writes in the American Economic Review, "Economists are reasonably confident that some combination of free markets and good institutions has an excellent historical track record of achieving development, as opposed to, say, totalitarian control of the economy by kleptocrats. It is just that we don't know how to get from here to there. Which specific actions contribute to free markets and good institutions? How all the little pieces fit together? That is, we don't know how to achieve development." Easterly doesn't think we should give up trying to help people in poor countries. Instead, we should do small, context-sensitive projects with measurable benefits. He writes, "Aid could seek to create more opportunities for poor individuals rather than try to transform poor societies." To be fair, the primary stumbling block to development in poor countries is not bad advice from rich countries. The best ideas for economic growth are quite simple. Yet, as this chapter has pointed out, there are plenty of leaders in the developing world doing the economic equivalent of smoking, eating cheeseburgers, and driving without their seatbelts. A study done by the Harvard Center for International Development of Global Growth Patterns between 1965 and 1990 found that most of the difference between the huge success of East Asia and the relatively poor performance of South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Latin America can be explained by government policy. In that respect, foreign aid presents the same kind of challenges as any other welfare policy. Poor countries, like poor people, often have very bad habits. Providing support can prolong behavior that needs to be changed. One study came to the unsurprising conclusion that foreign aid has a positive effect on growth when good policies are already in place, and has little impact on growth when they are not. The authors recommend that aid be predicated on good policy, which would make the aid more effective and provide an incentive for governments to implement better policies. Similar criteria have been proposed for relieving the debts of heavily indebted poor countries. Of course, turning our backs on the neediest cases and denying bailouts to countries in crisis is easier in theory than it is in practice. In 2005, the World Bank published a document that might qualify as bureaucratic introspection. Economic Growth in the 1990s, Learning from a Decade of Reform. Policymakers were a lot more confident that they knew how to fix the world in 1990 than they are today. Harvard development economist Danny Roderick describes the tone of the report, which seems to incorporate William Easterly's skepticism without abandoning Jeffrey Sachs' resolve. There are no confident assertions here of what works and what doesn't, and no blueprints for policymakers to adopt. The emphasis is on the need for humility, for policy diversity, for selective and modest reforms, and for experimentation. Last, much of the world is poor because the rich countries have not tried very hard to make it otherwise. I realize that pointing out the failure of development aid and then arguing for more of it is like Yogi Berra criticizing a restaurant for having bad food and small portions. Still, things become better when there's an overwhelming political will to make them better. That is bigger than economics. Epilogue. Life in 2050. 7 questions. Economics can help us to understand and improve an imperfect world. In the end, though, it's just a set of tools. We must decide how to use them. Economics does not foreordain the future any more than the laws of physics made it inevitable that we would explore the moon. Physics made it possible. Humans chose to do it, in large part by devoting resources that might have been spent elsewhere. John F. Kennedy didn't alter the laws of physics when he declared that the United States would put a man on the moon. He merely set a goal that required good science to get there. Economics is no different. If we are to make the best use of these tools, we ought to think about where we're trying to go. We must decide what our priorities are, what trade-offs we're willing to make, what outcomes we are or are not willing to accept. To paraphrase economic historian and Nobel laureate Robert Fogel, we must first define the good life before economics can help us get there. Here are 7 questions worth pondering about life in 2050, not for the sake of predicting the future, but because the decisions that we make now will affect how we live then. How many minutes of work will a loaf of bread cost? It's the productivity question. From a material standpoint, it's pretty much all that matters. Nearly everything else we've discussed, institutions, property rights, investment, human capital, is a means toward this end, and other ends too. If productivity grows at 1% a year over the next 4 decades, our standard of living will be some 50% higher by 2050. If productivity grows at 2% a year, then our standard of living will more than double in the same time frame, assuming we continue to work as hard as we do now. Indeed, that leads to a sub-question that I find more interesting. How rich is rich enough? Americans are richer than most of the developed world. We also work harder, take less vacation, and retire later. Will that change? There's something in labor economics called the backward-bending labor supply curve. Thankfully, the idea is simpler and more interesting than the name would suggest. Economic theory predicts that as our wages go up, we'll work longer hours, up to a point, and then we'll begin to work less. Time becomes more important than money. Economists just aren't quite sure where that curve starts to bend backward, or how sharply it bends. Productivity growth gives us choices. We can continue to work the same amount while producing more, or we can produce the same amount by working less, or we can strike some balance. Assuming Americans continue to grow steadily more productive, will we choose to work 60 hours a week in 2050 and live richly, in a material sense, as a result? Or will there come a time when we decide to work 25 hours a week and listen to classical music in the park for the balance? I had dinner not long ago with a portfolio manager for a large investment company who is convinced that Americans are going to wake up one day and decide that they work too hard. Ironically, he wasn't planning to work less hard himself. He was planning to invest in companies that make leisure goods. How many people will be sleeping under Wacker Drive? This is the pie-slicing question. In 2000, I was assigned by The Economist to write a story on poverty in America. With the economy still booming, I sought some way to express the striking dichotomy between America's rich and poor. I found it right outside the front door of my office building. A stroll down Wacker Drive in Chicago offers an instant snapshot of America's surging economy. Young professionals stride along, barking orders into mobile phones. Shoppers stream towards the smart shops on Michigan Avenue. Construction cranes tower over a massive new luxury condominium building going up on the horizon. All is bustle, glitter, and boom. But there is a less glamorous side to Wacker Drive, literally below the surface. Lower Wacker is the subterranean service road that runs directly beneath its sophisticated sister, allowing delivery trucks to make their way through the bowels of the city. It's also a favorite refuge for the city's homeless, many of whom sleep in cardboard encampments between the cement props. They are out of sight of all that gleams above, and largely out of mind. As Wacker Drive, so America. What are we willing to promise the most disadvantaged? The market economies of the developed world lie along a continuum, with America at one end and the relatively paternalistic European economies, such as France and Sweden, at the other. Europe offers the kinder, gentler version of a market economy, at some cost. In general, the European nations are more protective of workers and have a more substantial safety net. Generous benefits are mandated by law. Healthcare is a birthright. This leads to a more compassionate society in many ways. European poverty rates, particularly for children, are far lower than those in the United States. Income inequality is lower, too. It also leads to higher unemployment and a slower rate of innovation and job creation. Workers, bundled with lots of mandatory benefits, are expensive. Since employees cannot be fired easily, firms are slow to hire them in the first place. Meanwhile, generous unemployment and welfare benefits make workers slower to take jobs that might be offered. The result is what economists refer to as a sclerotic labor market. During normal economic times, European unemployment rates tend to be significantly higher than the American rate, particularly for youth. The American system is a richer, more dynamic, more entrepreneurial economy, and harsher and more unequal. It's conducive to creating a big pie in which the winners get huge slices. The European system is better at guaranteeing at least some pie for everybody. Capitalism comes in all kinds of flavors. Which one will we choose? Will we use the market in imaginative ways to solve social problems? The easiest and most effective way to get something done is to give the people involved a reason to want it done. We all nod as if this were the most obvious point in the world, and then we go out and design policies that do just the opposite. We have an entire public school system that still does not really reward teachers and principals when their students do well, or punish them when their students do poorly. We talk about how important education is, but we make it difficult and time-consuming for smart people to become teachers, despite evidence that this training has little impact. We don't pay good teachers more than bad ones. We make it artificially cheap to travel by car, implicitly subsidizing everything from urban sprawl to global warming. We assess most of our taxes on productive activity, like work, savings, and investment, when we might raise revenue and conserve resources with more green taxes. If we get the incentives right, we can use markets to do all kinds of things. Consider the case of rare diseases. However bad it is to have a serious illness, it's worse to have a serious illness that's also rare. At one point, there were some 5,000 diseases considered so rare that drug companies ignored them because they had no hope of recovering their research costs, even if they found a cure. In 1983, Congress passed the Orphan Drug Act, which provided incentives to make such work more profitable. Research grants, tax credits, and exclusive rights to market and price drugs for rare diseases, so-called orphan drugs, for 7 years. In the decade before the Act, fewer than 10 orphan drugs came to market. Since the Act, roughly 200 such drugs have come to market. Or something as simple as deposits for cans and bottles. Not surprisingly, recycling rates are much higher in states with deposits than in states without. There's also less trash and litter. And if landfill space is at a premium, which it is in most places, shouldn't we be paying to dispose of our household trash based on the volume we generate? What effect do you think that would have on the quantity of consumer packaging? Markets don't solve social problems on their own, or else they wouldn't be social problems. But if we design solutions with the proper incentives, it feels a lot more like rowing downstream. Will we have strip malls in 2050? Nothing says that we must accept what the market tosses us. New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis paid homage to the beauty of Italy's Tuscany and Umbria regions, the silvery olive groves, the fields of sunflowers, the vineyards, the stone houses and barns, and lamented that such small farms are not economical in a world of corporate agriculture, but says they should be preserved anyway. He wrote, "Italy is evidence that there is more to life, a civilized life, than the unregulated competition of the market. There are values of humanity, culture, beauty, community, that may require deviations from the cold logic of market theory." There is nothing in economics that says he's wrong. We may well collectively decide that we'd like to protect a way of life or something that is aesthetically pleasing, even if it means higher taxes, more expensive food, or less economic growth. To an economist and to Mr. Lewis, life is about maximizing utility, not income. Sometimes utility means preserving an olive grove or an old vineyard, just because we like the way it looks. As we grow wealthier, we're often more willing to put aesthetics above the pocketbook. We may invest resources in rural America because it's important to our identity as a nation. We may subsidize small farms in Vermont because they're beautiful, not because it'll make milk cheaper, and so on. That point comes with several heavy doses of caution. First, we must always make explicit the costs of fiddling with markets, whatever those costs may be. How is the outcome different than it would have been, and who pays? Second, we should take care that these costs fall most heavily on those who enjoy the benefits. Last and most important, we should make sure that one group, such as those of us who think that strip malls are hideously ugly, does not use the political and regulatory process to impose its aesthetic preferences on another group, those who own strip malls and the people who enjoy the cheap and convenient shopping there. That said, there's nothing to stop us from dreaming of a world without strip malls. Do we really have monetary policy figured out? I asked that question in the first edition of this book back in 2002. Here's part of the answer. The Japanese economy, that miracle of the 1980s, remains stubbornly resistant to traditional monetary and fiscal fixes, prompting what the Wall Street Journal has called one of the great economic debates of the age. Could something similar happen here? It did, beginning in 2007. That doesn't make me a genius, as I've also predicted that the Cubs will win the World Series on multiple occasions. It does prove that we have not conquered the business cycle, the economic ebb and flow that leads to periodic recessions. We thought we had it tamed, and then the financial crisis nearly took us right off the rails. These swings in the economy take a lot of innocent victims with them. Ben Bernanke and the Fed seem to have done a lot of things right. What have they done wrong that we don't know about yet? Remember, Alan Greenspan was a genius, keeping inflation in check, until he wasn't anymore, because loose money fueled the asset bubbles. There's a regulatory challenge as well. The discussions have started, but we're not anywhere near a solution. How do we manage the systemic risk in an interdependent financial system? The iron law of capitalism is that firms that fail should fail. We did that with Lehman Brothers, and it nearly took all of us with them. The global financial system does not look like a textbook model where strong firms thrive in a crisis and weak firms fail. It's more like a group of mountain climbers tethered together on the edge of a precipice. How do we allow the market to punish wrongdoers without sending all of us spilling down the mountain? In 40 years, will African tigers refer to wildlife or to development success stories? Here's an exercise. Find a young child, say age 8 or 9, and try to explain to him or her why much of the world lives comfortably, even luxuriously, while millions of people elsewhere on the planet are starving to death and billions more are barely getting by. At some point, the explanation just starts to feel inadequate. Clearly, we do not have a silver bullet for economic development. We don't have one for cancer either, but we haven't given up. Will the world be significantly less poor in 2050? The answer is not obvious. We can imagine an East Asian scenario in which countries transform themselves in a matter of decades. Or we can imagine a sub-Saharan Africa scenario, in which countries stumble from decade to decade without any significant economic growth at all. One scenario will lift billions of people out of poverty and misery. The other won't. When we ask whether poor countries will still be poor 4 decades from now, The question seems distant and abstract, almost as if the answer will be determined by some future alignment of the stars. But when we break that question into its component parts, when we ask about the things that we know will distinguish rich countries from poor countries, then global poverty seems more tractable. Will governments in developing countries create and sustain the kinds of institutions that support a market economy? Will they develop export industries that enable them to break out of the trap of subsistence agriculture? And will the United States open its huge market to those products? Will the rich countries use their technology and resources to fight the diseases that are ravaging the developing world, especially AIDS? Will the family of a baby girl born tomorrow in rural India have an incentive to invest in her human capital? Can America get its fiscal house back in order? The United States is the world's largest debtor. We owe Chinese bondholders more than $1 trillion. We've had to borrow heavily to pay our bills for the past decade. The sobering part is that some of our most significant government expenses lie ahead as the baby boomers retire and begin to claim Social Security and Medicare. The peace dividend at the end of the Cold War lasted about 45 minutes, so we seem stuck with large defense budgets for the foreseeable future. Math is math. Every reasonable calculation I've seen shows that our fiscal trajectory is unsustainable. So, what will we do about it? U.S. society has developed not merely an aversion to higher taxes, but a palpable hostility. That would be fine if we were willing to trim government to a size that we could fund, but we haven't done that either. Think about what that means. Going forward, somehow, we have to raise enough revenue to, 1, pay for whatever government we choose to have, which we aren't doing fully now, 2, pay the interest we've accumulated on past bills, and 3, pay for the new expenses associated with an aging population and expensive entitlement promises. That's going to require serious political leadership and recognition by Americans that the status quo is not an option. Simon Johnson, who had plenty of experience with financial crises as the former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund, has noted, "Overborrowing always ends badly, whether for an individual, a company, or a country." During the first decade of the new millennium, three parties borrowed heavily: consumers, financial firms, and the U.S. government. So far, two have paid a huge price for that leverage. Is there another shoe to drop? Those are just my questions. My hope is that by now, you have more of your own. The remarkable thing about economics is that once you've been exposed to the big ideas, they begin to show up everywhere. The sad irony of Econ 101 is that students too often suffer through dull, esoteric lectures while economics is going on all around them. Economics offers insight into wealth, poverty, gender relations, the environment, discrimination, politics, just to name a few of the things we've touched upon. How could that possibly not be interesting?
The End. You've been listening to Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science, by Charles Whelan, narrated by Karen McHugh. This book is copyrighted 2002 and 2010 by Charles Whelan. This recording is copyrighted 2010 by Recorded Books. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.